The foreseeable future, we've got mostly sunny days and mostly clear skies. Tonight, the low is projected to be around 51 degrees in Moscow. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, high about 80. Tomorrow night, mostly clear, low about 52. On Friday, sunny, high about 83. And Friday night, clear, a low of 50. Saturday, quite warm, 87 degrees. Oh, my. Saturday night, mostly clear, 55. Sunday, sunny, high of 91. And Sunday night, partly cloudy skies and a low of 57. So unless you live out in some of the outlying areas, I don't think you're going to have to worry about your tomato plants at all or covering anything yet. Monday, it's going to be again sunny, high near 91, partly cloudy Monday night, and mostly sunny, 88 on Tuesday, partly cloudy with a low around 54, and then mostly sunny on Wednesday. So there is no projected precipitation, at least in the near term. I wish there were some, but that's the way the weather is shaking out to be. Well, I found some at least new music to KRFP. It's actually it's rather interesting. It's some Iggy Pop, and I'm going to play a cover that he does of is sort of the anthem, or one of a couple of anthems of Edith Piaf, La Vie en Rose. So we'll see how Iggy Pop does with that song, and we'll come back, talk a little bit about fire, and maybe to take a break to save my voice, we will actually play the original version as it was sung by Edith. So here we go with a little Iggy Pop.
C'est bras, elle me parlait tout bas. Je vois la vie en rose. Elle me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon
Back the Wild Clearwater Country Show. That's kind of an interesting song, a little version of La Vie en Rose by Iggy Pop. He didn't use the conventional French singing when you pronounce the ending vowels, even though they're not pronounced in normal day speech. And so we'll hear a little bit later Edith Piaf's version of that song. But fire, oh boy, big fire news around the country. One of the hottest or driest droughts on record in the country. And guess what? Wow, we have big fires. And interesting news. That's actually, it is nothing short of obvious, I would think. But some people, it is not obvious. And that's, I think, what is so interesting. So let's take a little look at some of the narratives that are out there about fire. And let's look at their accuracy or lack thereof. There's a narrative that the Forest Service and the timber industry like to talk about, and that is that because of fire suppression, and they make sure it's fire suppression only and not other human factors, they emphasize fire suppression, that our forests are thicker and overgrown, and they're now fire hazards, and that beetles are coming in. So that's sort of idea number one, that a thicker forest lead to bigger and hotter and more dangerous and quote-unquote unnatural fires. Well, scientists are finding that is definitely not the case, especially in this part of the world. Here in the Northern Rockies, big hot fires are part of the system. They always have been, as far as we can go back at least in studying our records, and they probably always will be, barring some very major geologic events, at least in ecological time, big fires are going to be part of these forested ecosystems. And in fact, they're probably the dominant factor in shaping them. Perhaps the best fire ecologist right now out there, the one that's doing a lot of research, and he's not too popular among some other fire ecologists because he's calling people on their errors. He's pointing out the inconsistencies in study methodology. He's challenging people and saying, wait a minute now, you are operating under maybe a dogma rather than what the facts suggest. And that's Dr. Baker, William Baker out of University of Wyoming. And he has some very interesting studies that even in the drier forests that they were subject to big hot stand replacing fires, even though fires there tended to be a little bit more frequent historically, and they would burn through them, that a fire regime, and I think he's probably even challenging the whole idea of regimes, a fire regime that had what is called a high frequency but low intensity fires, and they generally, the scientists generally point to, and the Forest Service and others point to the ponderosa pine type as fitting that description. But even then, he's pointed out that even in those kind of drier forests, that this rule doesn't hold true. And in fact, that climatic events are what drive fire behavior. Yes, you need fuels, but there's fuels in clear cuts. There's fuels in other places. That logging is not going to prevent fire. In fact, in some instances, it increases fire. So there's a lot. And he just came out with some research with a colleague at University of Wyoming that is garnering a lot of attention. Very, 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 very interesting stuff. Of course, there's another myth out there that pine beetles and things that are killing the trees are actually increasing the fire hazard. Well, that's also probably not true. Pine needles, when they're green, actually, are more flammable because they have these volatile oils in them that light on fire. And if people can remember some of the big hot fires that we do have periodically here in this part of the world, like the fires in 1988 in around Yellowstone, the higher elevation lodgepole pine forest. Sometimes it would get so hot, they would spontaneously just explode into flame because the nearby fires were so hot, the heat was coming to an area, and even without the flames, it would just burst into flame because of the oils in the pine needles. When trees die, the pine needles drop to the ground, and in fact, they are perhaps less flammable, those forests. Another myth that, well, logging, as I mentioned earlier, prevents fires. In fact, there's research done by the Forest Service itself in the Sierra Nevada that show that logging, in fact, can exacerbate fires because what it does is when you open up the canopy, you open up the opportunities for sunlight to penetrate down to the floor and to dry out fuels, the floor of the forest. And so drier fuels, again, a climate-driven event leads to fire. So it doesn't really, quote, solve the situation. So those are some of the interesting events surrounding fire that have come across the scientific world. I'm going to talk about another one a little bit later on. But before we circle around back to science, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the recent policy events surrounding fire that are extremely and utterly ill-advised and stupid. The Forest Service is now decided that they're not going to let fires, whether natural prescribed, won't be used to improve elk and other wildlife habitat in wilderness and roadless areas, and that's per Clearwater National Forest. Now, this was an announcement that was from a week ago in the Lewiston Morning Tribune. You have to scratch your head. Why is this happening? Reacting to the unusually large number of devastating fires in the Southwest and drought conditions covering much of the country, the U.S. Forest Service adopted a fire suppression first wildfire fighting strategy. They are also reacting. Every fire is going to get some kind of suppression response, said Bob Lippincott, fire management officer for the combined forests. They'll try to put out even the smallest of remote fires during the initial attack. And it says, doing so will preserve national firefighting resources that are stretched thin and help control firefighting costs. Well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And I think many people in the Forest Service privately would agree. The natural fire policy actually was invented, one could say, and it evolved, and it started here in the Clearwater country. Started up on the White Cap Creek drainage, and then to the south, the Bear Creek drainage in the Selway, or to the north, the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness in the Clearwater River Basin. These are two tributaries to the Selway River. One is on the Bitterroot National Forest in the case of White Cap Creek, and the other, Bear Creek, is on what is now going to be the combined Nez Perce Clearwater National Forests. Well, that's about 40 years ago is when that policy just first got started. And since that time, the Forest Service claims there's a big mosaic out there because of these fires, and there's not necessarily room for fires to grow to huge sizes because they have allowed fires to burn in the past. And again, I think some of the science doesn't necessarily agree with the Forest Service dogma on that point, because look at the fires of 1910 when it was before fire suppression ever occurred, and the forest didn't... And fires were not put out prior to that point in time, yet because of climatic events, they grew very big and very large. So while I would take issue with the Forest Service's claiming that by allowing fires to burn the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, they are in essence preventing great big fires in the future, while I would take issue with that, it has been a success because it's created a mosaic of habitat types, and it makes the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness a wilder place. It contributes to long-term watershed stability because fires evolved in these systems with streams and whatnot, and they help recruit downwoody material and help with nutrients into streams. All this is important for long-term watershed health. Yes, in the short run, these are what they call pulse events, where the watershed may be slightly degraded, but usually within a few years after the fire, they return back to as they were before, unlike road building and logging, which tends to have a permanent scar in the landscape, especially with the roads that tend to stay. These are pulse events rather than what they call press or chronic sediment events. So the Forest Service's natural fire policy in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness started here, and now the Forest Service as an agency is repudiating that because they are trying to suggest that fires can all be put out. Well, that's certainly not proven to be the case in the Southwest this year because of drought and other reasons. And the Forest Service, I think, is taking a step backward in fire policy, and also think of being foolish financially. We're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. Give my voice a quick rest here. But I thought I would see if I can't play the Edith Piaf version of La Vie en Rose here, and we will come back and talk more about fire policy.
On baissait les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche. Voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras et me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur, une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, il a juré pour la vie. Dès que je l'aperçois, alors je sens en moi mon cœur qui bat. Des nuits d'amour à plus finir, un grand bonheur qui prend sa place. Des ennuis, des chagrins s'effacent, heureux, heureux à en mourir. Quand il me prend dans ses bras et me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur, une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, il a juré pour la vie. Et dès que je l'aperçois, alors je sens en moi mon cœur qui bat.
Baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours. Ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie. Des nuits d'amour à plus finir, un grand bonheur qui prend sa place, des ennuis, des chagrins s'effacent, heureux, heureux, à en mourir. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, le mot de tous les jours, et ça me fait quelque chose. S'il est entré dans mon cœur, une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est toi pour moi, moi pour toi dans la vie. Tu me l'as dit, pas juré pour la vie. Et dès que je t'aperçois, alors je sens dans moi mon cœur qui
back to Wild Clearwater Country Show. I have to apologize. I actually played two versions of La Vie en Rose. I thought I had the Edith Piaf version. A little bit of false advertising there from the internet. It was somebody else singing, but that second one, of course, was the late, great Edith Piaf with La Vie en Rose. Okay, back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show and fire. It's been quite a big fire year, but not so much here in the Wild Clearwater Country. In fact, one of the few places in the nation, at least in the lower 48, that's not experiencing some kind of heat wave and or drought, although our temperatures are warmer than I would like them to be there. You know, they're somewhat around a normal, although our July was a little bit below normal, and our August probably will be the same. That has been the trend, actually, for the last few years, and the other months have been just a little bit wetter, so we've ended up, you know, right around normal precipitation for this part of the world. But the Northwest tends to be in a little bit better condition in terms of drought, and so we're not having the kind of conditions that create big, large fires. And in fact, we're talking about some of the research. What it's showing out there is that fires are climatically driven events. And yet the Forest Service's response to this has been a one-size-fits-all category here, that you have to go out and suppress every single fire. They say that's going to save them money. Well, in the past, they could allow some of these fires, like in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, to burn, not really spend any money on them, but now they're going to the extreme expense of using helicopters and fire crews and others to put out fires that really do not need to be put out in the wilderness. And I think it makes absolutely no sense at all to do that. And the Forest Service is saying they're doing this for two reasons. One, as cost savings. That is patently false. It's not going to save any money. And number two, they say they're doing it because if they put out every fire, they will have more people to fight fires. Huh? That doesn't make sense either. If you jump on every fire, if some of you just let them go and just monitor them, and monitoring now is done with high-tech means, including aircraft, satellites, and whatnot. It's not so labor-intensive. Then you're going to have more firefighters. You have less firefighters that way than by trying to put out every single little fire and spending hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, on little fires that don't need to be put out, or even some big ones that could be burning away in the wilderness and making some important ecological changes, but trying to put those things out, that does not make any sense at all. So that's the current Forest Service policy. It is shaped out of fear and out of fiscal stupidity, and unfortunately, that seems to be the direction that the agency has been following, and that's too bad. Another interesting item, though, when it comes to forest policy, and it's reported also in the Tribune yesterday, an Associated Press article, The RAND Corporation said the agency should use water scoopers as core of the firefighting efforts, at least in terms of aircraft. And this is a think tank group, and they said the U.S. Forest Service should pursue a much different strategy for using airplanes to fight wildfires, one that relies more heavily on planes that scoop up water on the fly and less on air tankers that drop fire retardant chemicals and need to be reloaded on the ground at airports. Of course, there's been a lot of controversy and questions surrounding the safety of these chemicals and fire retardants, especially given the fact that sometimes these airplanes may not be the most accurate when they drop them, and firefighters get dumped on with these chemicals all the time, and there has been a concern about for firefighter safety from some of these chemicals as well. In fact, there was a lawsuit that several firefighters brought 5-6 years ago about this very issue. And the Forest Service chief says he agrees with many recommendations in the long-awaited report, but he does not agree with this report. He says, "We disagree with that because we feel some of the information they used is inaccurate," Tidwell told the Associated Press. And the RAND Corporation said in response, "We are adamant, about the validity of our scooper cost estimates and disagree strongly with Mr. Tidwell on that point," Keating said. And he is a representative, he was the lead author of the report, Edward Keating. And it says, "Right now, the Forest Service does not contract for any water scoopers to fight wildfires. A blueprint released in February for modernizing the aging air tanker fleet, which right now is made up largely of 60-year-old Lockheed airplanes." So that is one of the big issues right now that's facing the Forest Service. Now, what they mean by water scoopers is these are airplanes that have sort of pontoons on them. And what they do is they will land on a lake that's big enough where they can land. And then they pick up the water and they fly right from there. And there are some airplanes that have been designed specifically to fight fires and do exactly this, to land on lakes. And apparently some have been used by the Park Service. And the Forest Service has not even requesting any of those, apparently. So this has become quite a controversy. And it's very interesting because in Canada, as well as San Diego and Los Angeles counties, they every year contract a brand of firefighting airplanes that can scoop up water. So that's the other big news on the policy for the Forest Service. A big report comes out saying, well, if you're going to use aircraft, you ought to be a little bit more efficient and use these rather than ones that have to land in the expensive chemicals and whatnot. And there have been some of these air tanker crashes in recent years because some of these airplanes are very, very old. In fact, it wasn't that long ago that the Forest Service was still using the old B-17 and some other bombers from World War II era. And they were having some problems with keeping some of those older planes in the air, just the maintenance cost and the backlog. So that has become now the Forest Service policy. It is regressed to policy that's well over 50 years old. In the supposedly for cost savings and or given the drought situation, a very poor policy. And in many respects, it reflects very badly on the current administration and the current chief of the Forest Service to adopt a policy to put out all fires, including those in wilderness, and also not to listen to experts. If they're going to fight fires, they ought to do it in the most cost-efficient and effective manner possible. And apparently, the Forest Service does not want to listen to that either. So that's the sort of the policy landscape situation right now. There have been a few lightning strikes up in the wilderness and some up in some roadless country here in the Wild Clearwater Country. The Forest Service has immediately jumped on those fires and spent quite a bit of money in trying to put some of them out. In a year like this, they're probably not going to go exceedingly large. You'll have some fires that could do something up there. But we had a pretty wet spring, and it's probably not going to, these fires probably are not going to burn big and hot this year. So I'll take another quick musical break. I think I'll play a song from this Iggy Pop album, and maybe we'll play, let's see, something that's in English this time. So here we go with a little more Iggy Pop.
What is this thing called love? This funny thing called love. Just who can solve its mystery? Why should it make a fool of me? I saw you there one wonderful day. But you took my heart and you threw my heart away.
Back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. It's kind of interesting seeing probably the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop, singing some lounge songs, but it's kind of interesting. He played his version of La Vie en Rose, and now what is this thing called love? There we go. Back to the program at hand. Talked a little bit about just recent Forest Service fire policy and what's happening here around in the Wild Clearwater Country as a result of that. Again, we explained earlier that the climatic situation here is a little bit different. Yes, we're having our usual normal dry summers. In fact, the records are showing they're probably going to be a little bit drier than they have historically been. But our springs and falls have tended to be a little bit wetter than normal. And so we're sort of ending up maybe even a little bit more precipitation than normal. I had the wettest March ever on record. Although our July was a little bit below, I think our June was a little bit above normal. So we're not in danger of a huge fire year. But the Forest Service has decided to put out every single fire At the same time, they have had a long-awaited study on whether or not they should continue with their fire-retardant airplanes. And the study done by the RAND Corporation suggested they go to airplanes and other methods to put water on fires rather than to use fire retardant, that it was quicker and faster. And that seems to have been rejected by the Forest Service for various reasons of a cost benefit. By the Forest Service, and the RAND study was one that looked at the cost benefit, both from an economic, supposedly, and an ecological perspective. I think if any of them really looked at the real costs, they'd find out that maybe the whole firefighting program needs to be rethought. Finally, before we get in back into some more of the interesting science on fire, let's look at one last policy thing. There was a fire that was very close to a place where the Forest Service was going to be doing some prescribed fire, and they put it out this year. And I had some conversations with Forest Service people who will remain nameless because I think they don't want to, but they felt that this policy was not very wise this year. They thought it was going to end up being much more expensive and ecologically damaging in the long run, and but it was being adopted out of fear and out of for political reasons rather than for any sound ecological reason. Well, I think we could probably finish maybe the little discussion about fire here with some more recent research. And this is very fascinating because it gets into some sort of sensitive territory. So people don't like to want to bring up these kind of things. But it is important research. And I think to introduce a topic, we'll go to a couple of myths that have existed. Maybe one of the older myth is that in about 1491, that the entire continent of North America was a wilderness. And, you know, there are a few native people here, but it's basically completely wild. And that myth has been replaced by another one, that the entire North American continent was a human-dominated landscape because of those native people. Neither myth is accurate, although when you look at in terms of acreage and how much influence that native people had on an acreage basis, and given that much of North America is fairly inhospitable to human beings, at least in large numbers, that you would actually come out that with a number that's closer to the first myth that we talked about than the second one of the completely human-dominated landscape. But unfortunately, the science on this has been gotten caught up in all sorts of cultural biases and cultural wars and whatnot. So it's very, very difficult for scientists to do this, to look at some of this stuff. But interesting, and this is a study that also delves into climate. In the years after Columbus's voyage, burning of New World forests and fields diminished significantly, a phenomenon some have attributed to decimation of native populations by European diseases. But a new University of Utah-led study suggests global cooling resulted in fewer fires because both preceded Columbus in many regions worldwide. The drop in fire after about 1500 has been linked previously to the population collapse. We're saying no. There's enough independent evidence that the drop in fire was caused by cooling climate, says the study's principal author, Mitchell Power, an associate professor of geography at the University of Utah. And this is one of their news releases on the topic. The implication is that climate is a large-scale driver of fire. And that's what much of the research, and again, I would go back to what I said earlier, most researchers are now recognizing that climate is a driver of fire in forests and maybe even in other places as well, other ecological types. Climate is what drives these fires, and the story of fuels and these other things are, though important, are much less important. And that's a key finding. Climate is driving fire on global and continental scales, says Power, who also is curator of the Garrett Herbarium at the Natural History Museum of Utah, which is part of the university. The new study analyzed worldwide charcoal samples spanning 2,000 years. It will be published online during August in the journal The Holocene, which is the name of the geological epoch covering roughly the last 11,500 years of Earth's history. The study was funded by the National Science Foundation and the Natural History Museum of Utah. The study deals with the Little Ice Age, a period when Earth's climate cooled, causing New York Harbor to freeze over in 1780. Get that, New York Harbor froze over in 1780, among other effects. Estimates of when the Little Ice Age started range from the 1200s to the 1500s. It ended in the early 1800s. Possible causes include some combination of increased dust from volcanic eruptions, decreased solar activity, and changes in circulation of the ocean and atmosphere. The decrease in fire on a very large scale globally, and that's the key thing here, globally and in the Americas, was controlled by this cooling climate, which began prior to the population collapse, and climate alone is sufficient to explain large-scale changes in burning, says Power. In a cooler atmosphere, you tend to get reduced convection, so you get reduced thunderstorms and ignition from lightning, he says. Cooler climate also tends to maintain high levels of fuel moisture and soil moisture. Today, warming climate and drought have been tied to increasing fires in the U.S. West and elsewhere. Just what we've been saying. These are climatically driven events. In a world where climate is rapidly changing, we need to pay more attention to the relationship between climate and fire, Power says. And he conducted the study with 19 other scientists, including paleoecologist Frank Mayle, University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and climatologist Patrick Bartline, University of Oregon, other authors who provided charcoal data samples from the University of Wisconsin, Madison, and Oshkosh, Northern Arizona University, University of Göttingen in Germany, Canadian Forest Service, University of Montpellier in France, University of Bern in Switzerland, University of Calgary in Canada, University of Tennessee, Virginia Tech, University of North Carolina, University of Chile, Laval Université in Quebec, Fordham College in New York, and Central Washington University, not far from here. So this paper has been gathering a lot of attention, at least among fire ecologists and those types, on the internet recently, because what it does is it sort of challenges some long-held assumptions that people have had about, and some not so long-held, say maybe some short assumptions. It sort of challenges the second myth of the completely human-dominated landscape in 1491, and that indeed fire, and it challenges the myth that fires were a function of human ignition. That myth actually dates back many, 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 many decades. Some of the earliest scientists didn't realize that lightning started fires at all, and attributed all fires in the West when they came through. Some of the early researchers in the late 1800s came through and said, well, it looks like these places have burned. They must have definitely some very remote forests, including Lieberg, who did research here in the wild Clearwater country and also in parts of Oregon and northeastern Washington and northwestern Montana. He did his studies, I believe it was in the late 1890s, and he believed erroneously that fires were started by people, and they were not started by lightning. Now we're seeing that lightning is a good explanation for fire ignitions, and given how many lightning strikes, and we're finding out that that's exactly what starts fires. So some very, very interesting research about fires and fire ecology. We're kind of coming full circle. So climate tends to be the driver of fires. And that's what that research shows, as well as the fact that that human beings have very different cultures. Not every culture wants to necessarily manipulate vegetation intensively across the entire landscape, as does ours. And historically, maybe many cultures didn't do that for a whole bunch of reasons. For perhaps mainly among them, why? What reason was there for them to do that? There may not have been any good reason at all. They saw no benefit from doing so. So we'll come back here and sort of wrap things up with the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Play another little song here, one from the internet. We'll see if this works. This is kind of a sort of a garage rock rockabilly tune from north of the border in Canada. So it's kind of a cute, funny, crazy little song from Sonny Duval. So here we go with his tune.
J'ai vu Bibi sans bikini. J'ai vu Kiki sans parapluie, sa jolie robe était tombée, des gouttes brillaient sur ses pieds. Waouh! J'ai vu Kiki sans parapluie. Ils en tombaient en ricanant, Kiki dansait en riant, serrait les dents.
Back to Wild Clearwater Country Show. Been mixing up the music here to rest my voice. A little bit of a Sonny Duval from north of the border. His real name is François Duval. He's Quebecois from La Belle Province of Quebec. And he's quite an iconoclastic guitar player up there. He's actually a pretty good guitar player. And that was one of his sort of rockabilly sounding tunes. I think you can understand it, even in English, a little bit. Pretty simple rock and roll. Getting back to topic at hand, fire. Talked a little bit about some of the more recent research, both about historical fire use and what explains fires and the lack thereof in across North America and the world, and some. Recent research that looked at charcoal studies and concluded that fire frequency was a function of climate, and that there's also research out there that I didn't mention that indicates that in many areas, especially in our part of the world, the kind of this Northern Rockies region, for the most part, you know, there are some exceptions, but for the most part, lightning is the best explanation for historical fires, fires that occurred prior to European and Euro-American settlement and appropriation of native lands in this area, than does ignition by indigenous people, although that doesn't mean that it didn't occur. It's just that from a landscape scale, that lightning fires were most likely the driver behind some of those events and whatnot. So fire, fascinating topic. We may hear more about that this year, and we still have August and September. Though both are fairly warm and dry months, the three warmest and driest months of the year as part of the world, of course, July, August, and September. And I believe August and July are the two warmest and driest, and September is not far behind. Both are both months are somewhere around an inch of precipitation when you look at Moscow, Idaho itself, and on this part of the Palouse. And there isn't a whole lot more when you even go further up in the mountains, although it is a little bit wetter this time of year. So fire and climate, that's what drives fire. Climatic events are the things that ignite big fires. And there isn't usually a whole lot people can do about them. Perhaps it suggests that policy changes be made. And we're sort of lucky in this part of the world that, at least when it comes to national forests, there are not a lot of people that are building right up to the national forest. Of course, there's a lot of private and state-owned forest land in the Wild Clearwater region, and also some of the eastern part of the Palouse and some of the little upper elevations of the Palouse, because the Palouse was sort of the Palouse Prairie here, was kind of that eastern extent of the non-forested terrain. Moscow was just about historically that dividing line. Much further east, you started getting into forests. Of course, you drop down in elevation, then you're back into the non-forested types. But we live in a fire-shaped landscape, and people need to be very careful about where they place their houses and how they build their homes, and whether or not you use a cedar shake roof or one out of metal, especially if you live out in the woods that could catch on fire. Maybe a metal roof, although it may not be as pretty as a shake roof, it may be a lot safer for you. So I think I'll play another quick song and then end this version of the Wild Clearwater Country Show. I think I'll kind of end here with another song from Iggy Pop. It's kind of hard to get used to him singing these sort of songs, but here we go, a little tune from Iggy Pop.
Place I go, only the lonely go. Some little small cafe, the songs I know, only the lonely know. Each melody recalls a love that used to be, the dreams I dream, only the lonely dream of lips as soft as May, the hopeless schemes, only
that soon somewhere you'll find the one who used to care, and you'll recall each fun time, the picnics at the beach when love was new. It might have been the one time a hopeless little dream like this came true. If you find love, hang on to each caress and never let love go. For when it's gone, you'll know the loneliness, the heartbreak only, the lonely know.
All right, we're back to Wild Clearwater Country Show. Into their little song from Iggy Pop. Stick to punk rock, Iggy Pop. That's all I have to say about that song there. Well, let's look to take a little bit of look at the weather here before we wrap up this version of the Wild Clearwater Country Show. And again, remind everybody the topic of this show, fire and climate. Two inextricably linked items here in this part of the world. Well, looks like about 83 degrees out there at the airport as of the last report. Tonight, low about 51. Mostly sunny tomorrow, high about 80. Tomorrow night, low about 52. Friday, a high about 83. Friday night, low about 50 and high about 87 on Saturday. Oh boy, getting up into the 80s. Saturday night, low about 55. Sunday, high of 91 degrees, back into the 90s. Oh boy. Partly cloudy, low about 57 Sunday night. And Monday, partly cloudy in the evening, but the day again mostly sunny, a high near 91 again, 57. But Tuesday, a high near 88, mostly sunny. And Wednesday, mostly sunny as well. And partly cloudy evening, so not much change in the weather at all from current conditions that we've been experiencing here in the Palouse last week or so. Wasn't that long ago. It was kind of cold, but now we're into the summer high pressure, it seems. You are listening to KRFP Moscow. And now we go to some underwriting and between the lines.
KRFP thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
We are now no longer the knights who say, Nikki. We are now the knights who say,
KRFP Moscow.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James S. Henry, lead researcher on a new report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited, who summarizes his investigation into how the super-rich around the world have avoided paying taxes on an estimated $21 trillion of hidden wealth. Dustin Steele, an organizer with the group Radical Action for Mountain People Survival, who discusses his group's ongoing campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. And Ted Lewis of Global Exchange, who talks about this summer's U.S. Caravan for Peace, which is calling for an end to the violence in Mexico produced by the war on drugs. but first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.